8:30 a.m. Joseph Michael Valachi fears for his life. The 58-year-old member of the Genovese crime family, currently serving a sentence of 15 years for heroin trafficking, walks quickly across the prison yard. Valachi is the cellmate of Vito Genovese, to whom he has sworn a lifetime oath of allegiance. Valachi's official mob title is that of a low-level soldato, soldier, and as a made man, he has also taken a vow of omerta, silence under questioning. At 5'6" and a heavy-set 184 pounds, with a raspy voice and graying hair of an older man, Valachi does not appear to be a physical menace. But he has been a member of La Cosa Nostra for more than 30 years and knows how to deal with a threat. He does not attract attention as he wanders close to an area undergoing construction and quietly picks up a 2-foot section of iron pipe. Weapon in hand, Valachi knows he must act quickly. This is not the first time the diminutive mobster has plotted murder. He has been a criminal since the age of 9 while growing up in East Harlem, New York. At first, his specialty was driving getaway cars during robberies. But at the age of 27, he became a made man, a full-fledged member of the mafia, and was almost immediately involved as a soldato in the bloody 1931 Castellamarese War for control of organized crime in New York. It was Lucky Luciano who emerged victorious, and Valachi threw his allegiance behind the young Sicilian. When Vito Genovese took over the New York family following the 1957 murder of Albert Anastasia, Valachi had no issue switching loyalties. The actual number of deaths in which he is complicit is unknown, but the mobster is most prominently suspected of arranging the murder of fellow mafioso Stephen Franz at the behest of Genovese, luring Franz into a trap where he was strangled to death. Joseph Valachi has prospered in organized crime, owning 3 restaurants, a jukebox company, and a dress factory. His ex-wife Millie, whom he left for another woman after 25 years of marriage, knows all about his illicit lifestyle. Her father was Gaetano Reina, the founder of the Lucchese crime family, who was murdered by a shotgun blast to the head at age 40. Millie's brother Giacomo is Valachi's co-conspirator in the drug trafficking operation that landed the mobster in this federal penitentiary. Joseph Valachi has one son, Donald, a 26-year-old construction worker in New York who may not know what his father really does for a living. Valachi understands completely that if he uses this iron pipe in the manner he is now contemplating on this humid summer morning, the murder charge will most likely result in the death penalty. But the specter of the electric chair is preferable to a mob hit that would happen without warning. So Joe Valachi will take his chances. In the past, Valachi has offered minor bits of information to federal narcotics agents, hoping it might lead to preferential treatment or even a reduced sentence. He does not believe this qualifies him as an informant, a rat in mob parlance, and yet, he is under suspicion. One recent night in their cell, Vito Genovese made a rather unusual comment. "You know, we take a barrel of apples, and in this barrel of apples there might be a bad apple. Well, this apple had to be removed, and if it ain't removed, it would hurt the rest of the apples." Sensing danger, Valachi protests immediately. "If I'd done anything wrong, show it to me and bring the pills," he replies to Genovese, referring to poison, "and I will take them in front of you." "Who said you'd done anything wrong?" Genovese replies. Then the crime boss makes a most unusual statement. "We've known each other for a long time. Let me give you a kiss for old time's sake." The two men kiss on the cheek. At first, Valachi tries to rationalize the gesture's meaning, but eventually he realizes it is the kiss of death, customarily offered to men about to get murdered. Footnote: the kiss of death was meant to show friendliness toward an individual about to be murdered as a means of making him think he was not in danger. End footnote. Valachi will later recall that after this gesture of false affection, he just laid on my bed, but who could sleep? Whatever Genovese's motives for wanting him dead, Joseph Valachi knows who will do the killing. He believes that task will go to yet another inmate connected with the Genovese family, Joseph Di Palermo, a known enforcer for the crime boss. So Joseph Valachi decides to strike first. Pipe in his fist, he walks across the yard to where Di Palermo now stands. Before his imprisonment, Joe Beck, as Di Palermo is nicknamed, had a reputation as a drug trafficking mastermind. Di Palermo is 55, and despite his reputation as an enforcer, he has long survived by his intellect rather than by pure strength. It was Vito Genovese, at the Havana Conference 16 years ago, who first advocated that the mob begin selling drugs. But it is Di Palermo who has made it the mafia's most lucrative source of income. He procures heroin, marijuana, barbiturates, cocaine, and any other pharmaceutical substance his clients request. Though he now wears prison gray, Di Palermo was well known for his flashy behavior on the streets of New York, dressing in vivid blue suits, fedoras, and snakeskin shoes, and driving a matching blue Cadillac. As Joseph Valachi hefts the pipe in his right hand, the short, narrow frame of Joe Beck stands just a few feet away, back turned. So as Valachi steps forward to attack, his victim does not see the first time the iron pipe crashes down on the back of his skull. Or the second, or the third. Knowing guards will soon intervene, Valachi flails at Di Palermo's lifeless corpse until he is sure the capo is dead. But Valachi has made a mistake. The man bleeding in front of him is not Joe Di Palermo. Instead, Valachi has ended the life of Joseph Sopp, a convicted forger with no criminal ties to Vito Genovese whatsoever, but whose height and build tragically match that of Di Palermo. Footnote: Joseph Di Palermo, Joe Beck, was one of the most notorious drug dealers in history. Despite several stints in prison, he operated globally for more than six decades and was reputed to still be actively engaged in selling heroin when he died in 1992 at age 85. End footnote. In an instant, Joseph Valachi realizes he will soon be joining the unfortunate Sopp. After 40 years as a criminal, Joseph Valachi knows there is only one way to avoid the inevitable mob hit. He must become a full-fledged rat. The murder of 52-year-old Joseph Sopp is of little consequence, or so it seems. His remains are returned to Crawford County, Ohio, where he is buried in Mount Calvary Catholic Cemetery. The life of this small, thin felon was unremarkable, but the aftermath of his brutal death will change America forever. Once he makes known his willingness to speak on the record about the mafia, Joseph Valachi quickly disappears into federal protective custody. His whereabouts are unknown even to his ex-wife and son. In fact, he has been removed from the Atlanta penitentiary and relocated to the Westchester County Jail north of New York City. In exchange for a life sentence for murder rather than the death penalty, Valachi agrees to testify against the mob. Meanwhile, hitmen from several crime families scour the country in search of the informant, desperate to kill him before he can reveal their secrets. Agents of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics interrogate Valachi. Among the first questions directed at the mobster is when he joined the mafia. "Right after the war," Valachi responds. "World War I or World War II?" the agents want to know. "You don't understand," Valachi states before clarifying. "Right after the war with Chicago." Footnote: Valachi is referring to the Castellamarese War. From February 1930 to April 15, 1931, this clash between the Sicilian Old Guard and a new wave of gangsters ended with a complete restructuring of power in organized crime. The victors included many of the men who would rule the underworld for decades to come, including Lucky Luciano, Vito Genovese, Frank Costello, Bugsy Siegel, Albert Anastasia, Joe Bonanno, and Joe Profaci. End footnote. This glimmer of unique intelligence begins a steady stream of information about life in the underworld. When the narcotics agents have extracted as much information as they can, the FBI takes over the interrogation. In particular, Special Agent James P. Flynn makes it a priority to befriend the mobster and gain his trust. In January 1963, Valachi is moved from Westchester to the stockade at Fort Monmouth, New Jersey, to be closer to Flynn's office. Agent Flynn begins his work with simple discussions about helping Valachi lose 40 pounds in order to enjoy better health. Knowing that the mobster has a fondness for horse racing and has owned 4 thoroughbreds of his own, Flynn arranges for Valachi to receive the New York Daily News every morning. Before scanning the obituary page for the names of fellow mobsters, Valachi pores over the horse racing results and then sits down with Flynn to handicap the day's races at Belmont and Saratoga. Once their friendship is established, Flynn guides their talks into crime. Over the course of 8 months, the mobster submits to hundreds of hours of interviews, working 3 hours a day, 4 days per week. As information comes forth, it is shared with several governmental law enforcement agencies for fact-checking. Among them are the Treasury Department, Secret Service, IRS, and Postal Service. Amazingly, all of Valachi's information checks out. He never contradicts himself or is caught in a lie. In time, Valachi not only reveals specific details of unsolved crimes now connected to the mob, some performed decades ago, but also reveals the specific inner structure of La Cosa Nostra and its manner of committing specific crimes. According to Valachi, the lowest level of mafioso is the simple associate. Above them are the soldiers, then the capo regime, then underboss, then at the top, the boss. Parallel with the boss at this upper level is an advisor known as the consigliere. As a lifelong mafioso, Valachi has seen the rise of New York's 5 families and establishment of the National Crime Syndicate. He states for the record the names of individuals who first ran the families: Lucky Luciano, Tommaso Gagliano, Joseph Profaci, and Salvatore Maranzano. Then, Valachi gives up the names of the men currently running the 5 families: Tommy Lucchese, Vito Genovese, Joseph Colombo, Carlo Gambino, and Joe Bonanno. Publicly admitting even one of those names ensures Joe Valachi now has a price on his head. Confessing all 5 is to ask for the most brutal torture conceivable before the murder takes place. Even behind prison bars, Joseph Valachi will live the rest of his life in fear. The damage is done. The mobster's willingness to speak in detail about organized crime, heretofore basically a mystery, will forever change law enforcement's strategies for dealing with the mafia. With more and more disclosures forthcoming, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy grows excited about sharing this information with the general public. It is arranged that Joseph Valachi will appear before a Senate subcommittee looking into organized crime. And unlike the last group of mafiosi testifying before Bobby Kennedy's McClellan hearings 4 years ago, all of whom maintained their code of omerta by pleading the 5th Amendment, Joseph Valachi is expected to reveal all. As the date for Valachi's appearance before the Senate committee draws near, the time comes for Special Agent James Flynn to say goodbye to the mobster. The two men have become such good friends that Flynn would often bring Italian delicacies to Valachi's cell and then share a meal with the informer. Despite this close relationship, Flynn is sanguine about the mobster and his motives. Revenge was a large part of it, but it was also a cold, calculated move for survival. Don't think for a moment that this was a repentant sinner. He was a killer capable of extreme violence. He was devious, rebelling against all constituted authority, and he lived in a world of fear and suspicion. Fear especially marked him. Fear of what he was doing, and at the same time, fear that nobody would believe him. The result of Agent Flynn's patient interrogation has the unlikely effect of spurring a publicity war between J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department. On September 25, 1963, 2 weeks before Valachi is to testify before the Senate committee, a story titled "The Inside Story of Organized Crime and How You Can Help Smash It" appears in the national weekly magazine Parade. The byline is that of J. Edgar Hoover. Not to be outdone, Robert Kennedy authorizes family friend Peter Maz to write a book based on Valachi's testimony. In addition, Maz authors a story for the Saturday Evening Post about organized crime using details given to him by Bobby Kennedy. Director Hoover is furious when informed of Kennedy's tactics. "I never saw so much skullduggery," he writes. Then, ignoring the fact that he also personally published an article containing secret information, the director adds, "The sanctity of department files, including bureau reports, is a thing of the past. H." But Hoover is not finished. Continuing the war to take credit for the Valachi disclosures, he attempts to prevent the release of Peter Maz's book, The Valachi Papers. The matter will go to court. J. Edgar Hoover will lose. Bobby Kennedy is finally winning the war on organized crime. His most recent triumph came this past May when Jimmy Hoffa was indicted for charges of jury tampering. The case has not yet gone to trial, but that day will soon come. Kennedy's Get Hoffa Squad is at last seeing results for its vendetta against the union boss. In addition, the sheer volume of information obtained from Joseph Valachi is making a big difference for the Justice Department. "A principal lesson provided by the disclosures of Joseph Valachi and informants is that the job ahead is very large and very difficult," writes Bobby Kennedy in a special 24-page announcement on the eve of Valachi's appearance before the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. The date is September 27, 1963. "Evidence concerning their clandestine operation is particularly hard to uncover," Kennedy writes. "A witness who will testify in the face of threats to himself and his family is rare. This is one reason the disclosures made by Joseph Valachi are of such significance. For the first time, an insider, a knowledgeable member of the racketeering hierarchy, has broken the underworld's code of silence." As the Attorney General well knows, the last decade has seen the Kefauver hearings, McClellan hearings, and Appalachian Summit investigation, all futile attempts to penetrate the inner workings of organized crime. Valachi has changed all that. The government has gone from knowing nothing about the mafia to knowing almost everything. "The picture is an ugly one," Kennedy notes. "It shows what has been aptly described as a private government of organized crime, a government with an annual income of billions, resting on a base of human suffering and moral corrosion." Finally, the Attorney General summarizes, "We have been able to make inroads into the hierarchy, personnel, and operations of organized crime. It would be a serious mistake, however, to overestimate the progress federal and local law enforcement has made. A principal lesson provided by the disclosures of Joseph Valachi is that the job ahead is very large and difficult." It is October 1963, as Joseph Valachi appears before the 2nd McClellan Committee on Organized Crime. His testimony goes on for 6 days in public and one more session in private. He rambles as he answers the questions directed at him, often taking a break to suck on a lemon when his mouth gets dry. The Valachi hearings, as they will become known, are broadcast on national television. The American public soon learns of the ritual initiation ceremonies to become a made man, as well as the history of the mafia going back to the early 1930s. Valachi names names, telling which individuals run which crime families. He describes wars between rival families that resulted in the murders of dozens. And, to the chagrin of Vito Genovese, who has placed a bounty of $100,000 for Valachi's murder, the informant testifies that Genovese is the boss of all bosses and runs gambling operations in Nevada from inside his Atlanta prison cell. Joseph Valachi's appearance makes history. Upon completion of his testimony, he is returned to federal custody to spend the rest of his life in the penitentiary. It has taken Attorney General Robert Francis Kennedy 6 years of obsessive struggle to crack the secret code of organized crime. It seems nothing now stands in the way of RFK crippling the mafia. But something does. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The President of the United States is murdered on the streets of Dallas, Texas, shortly after noon on November 22, 1963. A lone gunman named Lee Harvey Oswald is arrested and charged with the crime. Jimmy Hoffa, awaiting trial, is eating lunch in Miami when he gets the news. As waitresses and busboys break down and cry, Hoffa stands on his chair and cheers. I hope the worms eat his eyes. Finding a payphone, Hoffa places a call to his lawyer. Frank Regano also counts Tampa crime bosses Santo Traficante and Carlos Marcello as clients, both of whom have sworn revenge on the Kennedy brothers. Regano and Traficante have just raised a glass in celebration of JFK's murder when the union boss calls. They killed the son of a bitch, chortles Hoffa. Footnote. In his 1994 book Mob Lawyer, Regano will claim publicly that Jimmy Hoffa requested that Regano contact the mafia about murdering the Kennedy brothers. End footnote. Given the Kennedy brothers' pursuit of organized crime and the number of high-powered mafioso who have promised vengeance on the president and attorney general, there is every reason to believe that the mob might have ordered the hit. The assassination has the appearance of organized crime involvement. Lone gunman, high-powered rifle, shots aimed at the head. Footnote. The authors of this work investigated a possible mob connection to JFK's assassination for the Killing Kennedy book. No hard evidence was found. End footnote. It is a warm Virginia afternoon, and Bobby Kennedy is at home sitting by his pool. The phone rings. J. Edgar Hoover is on the other end of the line. The director tells the attorney general that his brother, the president, has been assassinated. There is no emotion in Hoover's voice when he shares the brutal news. A shocked Bobby Kennedy places a hand over his eyes, then shares the news with the small crowd of friends on hand. His wife Ethel puts her arms around him. Within minutes, RFK is convinced that Jimmy Hoffa and the mafia might be involved, perhaps working together with Carlos Marcello or Sam Giancana. But no matter who carried out the hit, the Attorney General believes it is his fault. He has long believed that the mob would try to kill him, but RFK never anticipated they might go after his brother. I thought they'd get me, he confides to his press secretary, Ed Guthman. The Attorney General immediately asks Walter Sheridan of his Get Hoffa Squad if he knows of any connection among Hoffa, the mafia, and the assassination. The chain-smoking Sheridan and RFK have worked together since the first investigations of Teamster activities began several years ago. His official role is that of special assistant to investigate federal crimes, but his real talent is infiltrating the Teamsters Union by cultivating informants. Coincidentally, Sheridan recently learned from insiders the alarming news that Jimmy Hoffa has openly discussed the possibility of shooting Robert Kennedy. The job would be conducted with a high-powered rifle as he, the Attorney General, drives his convertible, the very same scenario that just transpired in Dallas. Walter Sheridan tells the Attorney General there is a very good possibility that Hoffa might have played a role in JFK's assassination. Bobby Kennedy immediately orders Sheridan to Dallas to oversee the investigation. J. Edgar Hoover is already there and sees to it that the FBI controls the crime scene. Just 2 days later, there's another shocking occurrence. A sleazy Dallas nightclub owner named Jack Ruby somehow manages to infiltrate the security detail protecting the accused assassin Oswald and shoots him dead. Immediately, rumors fly that Ruby, birth name Jacob Leon Rubenstein, has ties with organized crime. A subsequent congressional inquiry into the Oswald murder will later confirm this, revealing that Ruby, originally from Chicago, had a significant number of associations and direct and indirect contacts with underworld figures. In the end, Walter Sheridan will return to Washington to inform Bobby Kennedy that he was not successful in finding a connection among Jimmy Hoffa, the Mafia, and the president's murder. And so, suspicion lingers. Who really killed John F. Kennedy? The nation wants to know. Among Jimmy Hoffa's first comments to his attorney after the Kennedy assassination is an expression of relief. Bobby Kennedy is out as attorney general. But Hoffa is wrong. New President Lyndon Johnson requests that RFK stay on at the Justice Department. A grieving Bobby Kennedy agrees. His work is not done, and he has a very old score to settle. Hoffa. On March 4, 1964, Jimmy Hoffa is convicted of attempting to bribe a grand juror and sentenced to 8 years in prison. A separate conviction for fraud boosts that total to 13 years. His appeals process will continue for 3 years, but on March 7, 1967, Jimmy Hoffa begins serving his sentence at the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. Robert Francis Kennedy has finally gotten his man. Kennedy has not finished the job of eradicating the mafia, but his efforts and investigations have severely damaged America's alternate government, as he once referred to the mob. Bobby Kennedy's relationship with J. Edgar Hoover has always been tense, but having the president as a brother gave RFK the upper hand. That changes immediately after the assassination. Hoover no longer had to hide his feelings, Kennedy will acknowledge to friends, and he no longer had to pay any attention to me. One of the first RFK orders when he took over the Justice Department was that a special phone be installed in J. Edgar Hoover's office. This direct line to Kennedy's own desk was to only be answered by the director. Hoover long chafed at the appearance of being the Attorney General's subordinate and loathed the intrusion of that special phone. That direct line now goes unanswered. So while RFK was still Hoover's boss, Hoover would never deal directly or through me any longer, according to RFK. Both men are aware that John Kennedy had plans to replace Hoover during his second term in office when re-election would no longer be a factor. Now, J. Edgar Hoover makes sure that the new president, Lyndon Johnson, has no such plan. Hoover has a special relationship with Lyndon Johnson, to whom he has been funneling information about the sexual peccadilloes of congressmen and senators for many years. Before Johnson became vice president and was serving as Senate majority leader, the Texan was fond of using this political dirt to influence votes. John Kennedy's personal secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, will even claim that Johnson used Hoover's secret files to obtain the nomination for vice president. LBJ had been using all the information Hoover could find on Kennedy during the campaign, even before the convention, Mrs. Lincoln told an interviewer. In May 1964, President Johnson returns Hoover's favors, perhaps knowing that the director most likely possesses a file of Johnson's own numerous indiscretions. Standing in the White House Rose Garden, before a podium bearing the presidential seal, Johnson directly addresses Hoover. "Edgar, the law says you must retire next January when you reach your 70th birthday. And knowing you as I do, Edgar, I know you won't break the law." Hoover stands just behind the president, hands clasped before him. "But The nation cannot afford to lose you, LBJ continues in the twang of his native Texas, and by virtue of and pursuant to the authority vested in the President of the United States, I have just now signed an executive order exempting you from compulsory retirement for an indefinite period of time. J. Edgar Hoover is now director for life. Footnote. The cozy relationship between President Johnson and Director Hoover will reach its zenith just a few months later during the 1964 presidential campaign. At Johnson's orders, FBI agents will spy on Republican candidate Barry Goldwater's campaign by illegally wiretapping his plane and headquarters. This was not known until Hoover revealed it to Assistant Attorney General Robert Mardian in 1971. End footnote. On September 3, 1964, Robert Kennedy resigns as Attorney General of the United States. During his time in office, the Justice Department has indicted 687 organized crime figures with a conviction rate of 90%. Footnote. RFK had his eye on politics. There was considerable pressure on Lyndon Johnson to name Kennedy as his running mate in 1964, despite the fact that both men distrusted each other. Instead, on August 24th, Kennedy leased a house in New York. The following day, he declared his candidacy for the U.S. Senate. On November 3, 1964, Kennedy defeated incumbent Republican Kenneth Keating in a landslide. End footnote. But those triumphs are soon to be a thing of the past. Since JFK's assassination, J. Edgar Hoover has ordered the FBI to stop focusing manpower on investigating organized crime. With the conflict in Vietnam escalating into actual war, he now prefers to focus on political violence, the civil rights movement, and foreign espionage. Thus, the war on organized crime is over. For now. Meanwhile, the mafia quickly moves to monetize their sudden advantage. A primary target? The heavyweight championship of the world. Chapter 18. May 25, 1965, Central Youth Center, Lewiston, Maine, 10:30 p.m. Muhammad Ali is under armed guard. The 23-year-old heavyweight champion of the world is about to defend his title in this small ice hockey arena. His opponent is former champ Sonny Liston, whom Ali beat by technical knockout 1 year ago. At the time, Ali went by his given name of Cassius Clay. But he has since converted to Islam and become a follower of Elijah Muhammad, leader of the militant Nation of Islam group. Just 3 months ago, three NOI members assassinated a rival cleric named Malcolm X, shooting him 21 times. There are now fears that Ali will be the target of a revenge killing. Thus, the unlikely cordon of FBI agents and bow-tie-wearing Nation of Islam bodyguards protecting the fighter as he prepares to enter the ring. Though it is ludicrous for a boxing match of this magnitude to be held in such a small, out-of-the-way location, fears of organized crime influence over the event forced it to be relocated from Boston. Boxing fans and gamblers can watch via closed-circuit television, which will be flashed around the world. Now, as thick clouds of tobacco smoke waft through the arena, the paid crowd of 2,434 takes their seats alongside a rowdy band of students from nearby Bates College, all of whom received free tickets as part of a giveaway to fill the house. 200 police officers are also in the arena to ensure maximum security. Footnote. The fight was originally scheduled for the Boston Garden, but was moved because of Liston's arrest record and the lack of a Massachusetts promoting license by Intercontinental, the company organizing the bout. Intercontinental was in the business of promoting fights and was suspect in the eyes of state authorities. End footnote. Photographers press against the ring, taking photos of the muscled, athletic Ali as he steps through the ropes wearing white shorts and calf-high boxing shoes. Liston is the exact opposite, wearing black shorts and shoes. Prior to their first match held in Miami Beach, Liston entered the ring as not just the undisputed champion of the world, but also a fighting force that redefined heavyweight boxing. Known as the Big Bear, the 6'1", 213-pound Liston was lightning fast, his fists measuring 15 inches around, so large that he needs custom fighting gloves. One former manager, the Mafia-connected Frank Mitchell, describes him as having the mind of a 12-year-old child. He has no finesse, tact whatsoever. But for all his fame, Sonny Liston lives a life shrouded in trouble. His actual date and place of birth are unknown, shifting from 1929 to 1932 over the course of his career. He is fond of drink, and there are even reports that he had alcohol on his breath during his first fight with Ali. His Arkansas childhood was brutal. He was born the 24th child of a twice-married sharecropper, of whom Liston went on record as stating, "The only thing my old man ever gave me was a beating." The boxer is illiterate and took up fighting while serving time for burglary in the Missouri State Penitentiary. Released in 1952, he was sent back to prison for 6 months in 1956 after breaking a police officer's leg and stealing his gun. That incident has not been forgotten by the general public. In fact, Liston is such a polarizing figure that Congress openly debated whether he should be allowed to fight Floyd Patterson, then the heavyweight champion of the world. There were fears that a Liston victory would undermine the gentleman's sport of boxing. Liston was even called to appear before the Senate to explain himself on December 13, 1960. Baseball great Jackie Robinson spoke out publicly in favor of Liston, while President John Kennedy urged Patterson to find an opponent with better character. Little did JFK know about Liston's connections with the mob. The former champ has such a high-profile history of associating with mobsters that Sports Illustrated magazine exposed him in a 1961 profile. The story proved to be so accurate that it was admitted as evidence in a case before the New York State Athletic Commission, which denied Liston a license to fight. It would be unrealistic to deny that John Vitale and Blinky Palermo, a Carbo lieutenant, control Liston, the Sports Illustrated story states. Footnote: Frankie Carbo was a member of the Lucchese family who went on to become a leading boxing promoter, even while serving a 25-year prison sentence. Attorney General Robert Kennedy was chief prosecutor in the case against him. End footnote. There was ample testimony at the Kefauver hearings to indicate that Vitale and Palermo shared in Liston's purses. In 1958, the mob moved Liston out of St. Louis to Philadelphia and got him a new manager, Joseph Pep Barone, two arrests, who had never managed a fighter until he was given Liston to handle. Barone is a longtime associate of Palermo's. Footnote: John Vitale became head of the St. Louis crime family and died of natural causes. Blinky Palermo, who had previously testified before the Kefauver Committee on Organized Crime, was sentenced to 25 years in prison for mob activities related to boxing. Pep Barone died of a heart attack at the age of 66, also having testified before Congress about racketeering in boxing. End footnote. The magazine went on to document Sonny Liston's sordid life. Phone company records indicate that several of Liston's previous opponents were in touch with John Vitale, the Sicilian-born underboss of a St. Louis crime family who has served time in prison for narcotics trafficking. Because of that and other circumstantial evidence, some in the boxing world believe that Liston was involved in a number of fixed fights. On September 25, 1962, Sonny Liston and Floyd Patterson finally squared off in Chicago. Liston took the title from Patterson in stunning fashion, hammering him to the canvas just 2 minutes into the first round. Patterson was so embarrassed that he donned a fake beard to disguise himself from reporters on his way out of town. A subsequent rematch in Las Vegas 1 year later went the same way, with Liston knocking Patterson down 3 times before he was counted out with a minute left in the first round. In between the first and second Patterson fights, Sonny Liston made the acquaintance of a bookie named Ash Resnick. The 48-year-old, 6'1" former college basketball star from New York is a professional gambler and Las Vegas fixture. Resnick made it a point to become Liston's personal assistant, offering Sonny everything from fine clothes to escorts, in the words of one friend. Resnick is also close friends with legendary boxer Joe Louis, who has fallen on such hard times that he serves as an enforcer when Resnick calls upon clients whose wagers are past due. On February 25, 1964, Sonny Liston defends his title against 22-year-old Cassius Clay in Miami Beach. The Louisville Lip is an Olympic gold medalist with a penchant for showboating and a reputation as a light puncher. Liston, now in his mid-30s, despises Clay. The root of the angst is that Clay, who was fond of showing up in Las Vegas while Liston was training for the second Patterson fight, then publicly taunted the champ, saying he would destroy him once they got in the ring. In one altercation, Clay confronted Liston at the Thunderbird Casino. Liston was playing craps, and the two began jawing. Pulling himself up to his full height, Liston pressed his face close to Clay's. He is surprised that the younger man is 2 inches taller, but insults him anyway in a voice heard by the crowd. "Listen, you nigger faggot, if you don't get out of here in 10 seconds, I'm going to pull that big tongue out of your mouth and stick it up your ass." Liston allegedly then drew a handgun and aimed it at Clay to make his point. Footnote: that incident was recounted by promoter Harold Conrad to Thomas Hauser, an Ali biographer. End footnote. So in the lead-up to the first Clay-Liston fight, the confident heavyweight champ had no fear of the Louisville Lip. Having won most of his recent fights in the first or second round, Liston sees little need to train. Rather than run 5 miles a day, he does just 1 mile. Prostitutes visit his training camp. He seldom enters the gym, preferring to drink beer and eat hot dogs. Nevertheless, bookie Ash Resnick advises his gambler friends to put big money on Liston, a 7-to-1 favorite. But by fight time, serious money is being directed toward Clay. The odds plummet to 2-to-1. Resnick very quietly puts his own wager on the Lip. There are 2 ways to fix a fight. The most common and legal is mismatching opponents, pitting a top boxer against another with much less ability. The other is to pay one of the fighters to take a dive, fall down, and accept the loss by pretending to be knocked out. The mafia prefers the second method because it controls the outcome, allowing wagers to be placed with the certainty of winning. This appears to be what occurs during the first Liston-Clay fight. After 6 rounds of fighting, Sonny Liston spits out his mouthpiece. He is exhausted and looks old. Liston remains sitting on his corner stool as Cassius Clay strides to the center of the ring. By choosing not to answer the bell for the 7th round, Liston hands Clay a stunning victory by technical knockout. When Liston's mother calls him at his hotel afterward, he explains, "I did what they told me to do." Footnote: the quote comes from E.B. Ward, Sonny Liston's oldest brother, who was also on the call. End footnote. Almost immediately, allegations surface that the fight was fixed. A U.S. Senate subcommittee opens an investigation. Acting on direct orders from J. Edgar Hoover himself, the FBI also looks into the matter, specifically rumors that a well-known Las Vegas gambler and friend of Sonny Liston, Ash Resnick, is involved in rigging the contest. All findings are to be sent to Hoover's desk. But the FBI comes to no conclusions before a lucrative rematch is booked. In Maine, the audience cheers as Sonny Liston enters the ring, followed by 4 police officers. Ali is next, booed as his protection force flanks him. The audience settles in as Robert Goulet sings the Star-Spangled Banner, forgetting many of the words. Lines at the concession stand are long and slow, leaving many seats unoccupied as the fight begins. Almost all those waiting to buy their food will miss the most controversial punch in boxing history. Just a few weeks before the fight, a Las Vegas boxing gym owner named Johnny Tocco runs into John Vitale, the St. Louis crime boss who is among the mafia figures controlling Sonny Liston. Vitale jokes that Tocco should be happy that he's watching the fight on television rather than traveling all the way to Lewiston, Maine. When Tocco asks why, Vitale responds that the fight will end in the first round, which is exactly what happens. The odds are 8-5 in favor of Liston as the bell rings to start round one, but the smart money is betting against him. FBI Special Agent William Romer, who specializes in organized crime and was the man responsible for planting listening devices in the headquarters of the Chicago mob, will state that the Bureau learned that there very definitely had been a fix in the fight. Muhammad Ali is an intelligent man, but never did he envision what is about to happen in this small main building. 1:44 into the first round, Muhammad Ali snaps a right hand towards Sonny Liston's chin. It does not appear to connect, but Liston immediately slumps to the canvas. Ali stands over his fallen opponent, bicep curled, as he screams at Liston, "Get up and fight, sucker!" Looking over at his corner, a confused Ali asks, "Did I hit him?" Referee Jersey Joe Walcott, himself a former heavyweight champion, stops the fight at 2:12 into the first round. "Fake! Fake! Fake!" chants the audience. Boos and cries of "fix" then rain down from the crowd as Muhammad Ali raises his hands in triumph. The fallout is immediate. Some call for the abolition of professional boxing in America. The FBI is now under extreme pressure, and its investigation intensifies. It will lead nowhere. Footnote: an FBI memo concluded of Ash Resnick, "He is the fix point of two heavyweight title fights, both Liston. He has been and always will continue to be a corruption source for professional sports." However, the federal investigation went no further, although the FBI continued looking into Resnick for another decade. It is important to note that Muhammad Ali knew nothing about any efforts to fix the fights with Sonny Liston, according to the FBI. End footnote. As Muhammad Ali leaves Maine with a heavyweight crown, millions of wagers have been lost. But the mob knows that the outcry over the second Ali-Liston fight will soon die down. Bobby Kennedy no longer leads the Department of Justice, and no one else there will aggressively look into organized crime. That estimation will be proved correct. The FBI focuses its entire investigation on gambler Ash Resnick, who allegedly made $1 million from the first Liston-Clay fight. But the inquiry goes no further. In June 1965, the FBI is told by United States Attorney Alton Lessard that no criminal charges will be filed. The Bureau is advised that further investigation will be fruitless. So it is that the Liston-Ali scandal simply disappears. But the murder of Bobby Kennedy is not so easily forgotten. Chapter 19. June 5, 1968, Los Angeles, California, 12:15 a.m. Juan Romero hears the deafening celebration. The 17-year-old busboy works in the kitchen at the Ambassador Hotel, a legendary local landmark long frequented by Hollywood celebrities. But on this night, it is not a movie star holding center stage. An entirely different sort of famous individual is galvanizing the hotel's embassy ballroom with his words of hope and reconciliation. His name is Robert Kennedy, and he is running for President of the United States. It is election night for the California presidential primary. The polls closed 4 hours ago. All evening long, Romero has borne witness to the Kennedy faithful in their white Kennedy for President Panama hats, nervously awaiting results, then finally cheering with elation as RFK is crowned the winner just before midnight. The room is in a frenzy as Bobby Kennedy addresses the audience in a lengthy and personal victory speech, his supporters on their feet and reporters standing in a large crush on the stage surrounding the candidate. Kennedy speaks about all that is now dividing America, the newfound realization that the Vietnam War is unwinnable after the disastrous Tet Offensive, the race riots in major cities in the wake of the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, the division between poor and affluent. "We can start to work together. We are a great country," Kennedy tells the crowd, "a compassionate country, and I intend to make that my basis for running." As the crowd cheers Kennedy off the stage, Juan Romero is startled to see the candidate enter the kitchen. The awestruck busboy stretches his arm out as far as he can to get a handshake from this famous man. To Juan's delight, he feels Bobby Kennedy's palm and fingers wrap around his own. The handshake is brief, but one that Juan Romero will never forget. Then, in an instant, the deafening sound of gunfire echoes off the kitchen walls. Bobby Kennedy falls backward and sprawls onto the floor, his eyes closed and arms outspread. Romero, wearing black pants and a white collarless busboy shirt, immediately kneels. He puts his hand under Kennedy's head to keep it from the cold concrete floor. The senator's lips are moving, so the busboy places his ear to Kennedy's mouth to hear what he's saying. "Is everybody okay?" RFK asks. "Yes, everybody's okay," Romero answers. The busboy feels a warm stream of Kennedy's blood flowing through his fingers. From the embassy room comes a cry over the same microphone the candidate used just moments ago, asking if there is a doctor in the room. Juan Romero has a string of rosary beads in his shirt pocket. He wraps them around Kennedy's right hand. "He would need it more than me," the busboy later remembers thinking. Then they wheeled him away. Footnote: Juan Romero died of a heart attack in 2018 at the age of 68. A 24-year-old Palestinian immigrant named Sirhan Sirhan was convicted of murdering Robert Kennedy and is serving a life sentence at the Richard Donovan Correctional Facility in California. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told Bill O'Reilly in an interview that the Kennedy family believes that Sirhan did shoot his father, but likely had help. RFK Jr. stated, "Because an 8-chamber revolver cannot fire 9 shots, much less 13, we know that a second gunman must have been firing in the Ambassador Hotel party on the night my father died. However, an FBI investigation into the assassination could produce no compelling evidence that another person was involved. It is worth noting that J. Edgar Hoover oversaw the investigation." End footnote. 1 year after the murder of Bobby Kennedy on the other side of America, a member of the Genovese crime family named Fat Tony Loria wonders if his secret gay lifestyle will get him assassinated. Loria and other members of the mob have no connection to the changing social mores of America in 1969. Organized crime remains what it has always been, a money-making machine, not interested in ideological politics. Loria owns a bar catering to homosexuals on Christopher Street in Manhattan's Greenwich Village. This is not unusual in the mafia, for almost all gay establishments in New York are controlled by the mob. Fat Tony bought the Stonewall Inn, as it is known, in 1966 for $2,000. His partner is Matty the Horse Ianiello, who also owns the Haymarket in Times Square, the Gilded Grape, favored by crossdressers, and the Peppermint Lounge, all gay bars in Manhattan. The Stonewall Inn was a low-earning, straight establishment at the time of Fat Tony's purchase, but Loria reopened it as a gay bar. The establishment's name likely came from a memoir, The Stone Wall, which featured graphic depictions of lesbian love and was published in 1930, the same year the original Stonewall Inn opened as a speakeasy masquerading as a tea room. Stonewall was a code the gay crowd knew well. Now, on the night of June 27th, the Stonewall is packed with its usual mix of drag queens, openly gay men, and homosexuals still in the closet. Thick cigarette smoke hangs over the narrow room, and a jukebox plays dance music. There are two bars, and the walls are painted black. Plywood covers the windows to prevent the prying eyes of the police from seeing inside. The Stonewall is known as a great place to socialize, although some consider it too uptight. Most important, a bouncer stands at the double doors of the main entrance, not letting anyone inside until they have been scrutinized through a peephole to ensure that they are regular customers or at least have the appearance of being gay. Raids by Lily Law, the New York City Police Department, occur at least once a month, and Fat Tony is extremely cautious about letting undercover officers inside his club. Tony more than lives up to his nickname, once weighing in at 420 pounds. He was married and divorced, but now lives with a gay Italian man, though the two have never revealed the true nature of their relationship. Sex with another man is forbidden in the mafia world, and Fat Tony could take a bullet to the head if his true sexual inclinations are ever discovered. Yet, while the mob forbids homosexual relations among their own, they are more than happy to profit from the gay lifestyle. The mafia's involvement in prostitution is not limited to women. "Keep your zipper open and your mouth shut," is a saying often used among male prostitutes controlled by organized crime. It is establishments like the Stonewall Inn that provide the mob a lucrative source of income. However, it is a tricky business. Homosexuality is not against the law, but serving alcohol to openly gay customers is said to be a violation of the state liquor authority's ban on disorderly houses, and the SLA refuses to license such establishments. To the mafia, this presents a unique business opportunity. Instead of seeking a legal permit to sell alcohol, a private bottle club is formed. All patrons are members and must sign in, most often using an alias. Fat Tony takes full advantage of his clientele. Because there is no running water behind the bar, glasses are dumped into a sink after each use and simply wiped clean before reuse, sometimes leading to hepatitis. Everything in the house, from the cigarette machine to jukebox, goes to the mob, and the bottled liquor is watered down, then resold at exorbitant prices. Like the rest of the mafia, Tony Loria never had any use for Bobby Kennedy or Martin Luther King, the civil rights advocates slain within 2 months of each other in 1968. Kennedy was an avowed opponent bent on bringing down the mob, and the racial equality preached by MLK is totally rejected by La Cosa Nostra. In fact, the mob is so racist that many of its social clubs have a strict no-blacks policy. Footnote: in an extraordinary departure from this policy, hitman Gregory the Grim Reaper Scarpa of the Colombo crime family was approached by the FBI in 1964 about helping find missing civil rights workers James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner in Mississippi. J. Edgar Hoover was under media pressure to locate the graves of the three individuals who were thought to have been murdered. After the FBI's legal methods failed, Scarpa was secretly paid $5,000 to do the job. He was already connected to the FBI as a sometime informant. After flying to Mississippi, Scarpa located a known member of the Ku Klux Klan, forced a gun barrel down his throat, and demanded to know the location of the bodies. The terrified Klansman immediately told Scarpa the precise burial spot. End footnote. And while the Vietnam War may impassion others, for and against, the conflict represents just another way of making money for organized crime. An estimated 15-30% of American soldiers fighting in the war actively use illegal narcotics. The mafia is only too happy to continue providing them drugs upon their return home. Things do not end well for Fat Tony Loria. His lifestyle eventually leaks out. Loria's father, also a mob boss, disowns him. Eventually, Tony simply disappears. A message has been sent. The assassination of Robert Kennedy in Los Angeles once again opens the door to a growing number of conspiracy theories, much like what happened after the murder of JFK in 1963. Some of these involve organized crime. Mob leaders like Santo Trafficante and Carlos Marcello become the subject of scrutiny. But it is in New York that mob turbulence reaches an all-time high. Shortly after the assassination of President Kennedy, Joseph Bonanno, leader of the crime family bearing his name, attempts a total takeover of the five families. But when this ambition is discovered, the nationwide coalition of organized crime known as the Commission takes action, declaring all-out war on Bonanno. Mob underbosses Gaspar Di Gregorio and Paul Sciacca are promoted to replace him. Joe Bonanno fights back. The deaths pile up one by one. Carlos Simari, a Bonanno soldier, is gunned down outside his home in Brooklyn. Another soldier, Joe Badalamonte, is shot to death in Brooklyn as well. Vince Jimmy Lefty Cassese and Vince Vinnie Carroll Garofalo are gunned down in front of a bakery. Bonanno's bodyguard, Salvatore Big Hank Perrone, is shot dead while purchasing cigarettes at a candy store. But it is not just Joe Bonanno's loyalists who die. At the 1967 Cypress Gardens massacre, three Di Gregorio Sciacca family capos are machine-gunned to death in a Queens restaurant. Other soldiers from that family are also murdered. The bloody gang war lasts 6 years. It becomes so intense that Joe Bonanno flees to Arizona. But that does not stop the fighting. It is only after a series of bombings in Tucson targeting the crime boss that he officially steps aside in November 1968. He has led the family since 1931. At the time, Bonanno was the commission's youngest ever boss. He was in charge when J. Edgar Hoover's attention was focused on names like John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Bonnie and Clyde, rather than the mafia. He has been in power long enough to have played a role in every major underworld event since then. Havana, Apalachin, and Bobby Kennedy's Senate hearings. Joe Bonanno has seen it all, but is now forcibly retired. The beginning of the 1970s marks a dramatic time for organized crime. The Bonanno Wars have just ended. The disarray and uncertainty that marred the conflict have led to a destabilization of the commission, a breakdown of its authority. Soon, the code of silence, omerta, will be overlooked by some high-ranking mafia criminals, even though the death penalty for talking is still in effect. As traditional mob power changes, so does behavior. However, one thing does not change. Talking about organized crime in public can get you killed. Chapter 20. December 23, 1971, Detroit, Michigan, 8 p.m. Jimmy Hoffa still talks too much. Teamster leadership is gathered with their families here at Carl's Chop House for a Christmas celebration. The dance floor is full and drinks flow freely. A polka band clad in ruffled shirts and tuxedos provides the music. A brightly decorated Christmas tree and inflatable Santa Claus centerpiece add to the holiday spirit. It is a night for merriment, and nothing raises the crowd's spirits more than the news that James Riddle Hoffa was released from prison at 4 p.m. today. President Richard Nixon commuted his sentence to the 5 years already served. Nixon is running for re-election in the coming year and has been assured he will receive Teamster support for this act of largesse. Footnote: you can view the party at Carl's Chop House on YouTube. End footnote. Already the revelers here at Carl's, a regular Teamster hangout, are showing their colors. "I'm very happy," one official tells the reporters who have crashed the party. "I think President Nixon has done us a great service." Another Teamster joyfully adds, "With Jimmy out of jail, it's going to be the best Christmas ever." But not all are so happy. Current Teamster President Frank Fitzsimmons does not believe Jimmy Hoffa is capable of staying out of Teamster affairs. He has formed his own Get Hoffa Squad, this one consisting of union members told to be on the lookout for Hoffa meddling in local affairs. A key proviso of Hoffa's prison release is that he refrain from participating in Teamster leadership until 1980. Fitzsimmons, fearing Hoffa will once again take control of the union, insisted that Nixon include these terms. However, speaking to reporters outside the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary, Hoffa makes it clear that he will not let the President of the United States or the President of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters dictate what happens next. "I will determine whatever I'm going to do politically after I learn what the restrictions are," Hoffa boldly states. When pressed by reporters about the restrictions Nixon put on you, forbidding you from running for union office, he pleads ignorance. "I am unaware of any restrictions," Hoffa states firmly. The union boss wears a gray suit, blue tie, and brown shoes. He is visibly thinner and suffers from a mild case of diabetes. It is known that his wife Josephine has developed a heart condition. But other than health issues, the future appears bright for Jimmy Hoffa. As the interviews wind down, Hoffa turns to look at the penitentiary one more time. He thrusts a defiant fist into the air for the inmates to see. Then he steps into a car to be driven to the airport where a private plane awaits. As the revelers at Carl's Chop House know, Jimmy Hoffa is alive, well, and on his way. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover is late for breakfast. It is May 2nd,